My name is Paul Mortensen. I'm an alcoholic. And I have not taken a drink since May 5th of 2001. As I like to say, that is due to the grace of a God that will never help me, sponsorship that should not be trusted, and a simple program of action that's never going to work anyway. I wandered into AA by accident. I didn't plan on being an alcoholic. I didn't plan on going to AA, really. I sure as hell didn't plan on speaking at a roundup. Come to think of it, I want to thank Adam M., who's the one who asked me to speak at this. And the way that, a brief history, the way this whole meeting and this whole roundup and all this jazz came about is Adam and Dustin and this guy Ryan had evidently started a meeting. It was a speaker meeting other than our home group on the night the women's meeting was, out of a resentment against the women's meeting. And went all right for a while and then didn't. And so what happened is I was given a guy that I sponsor a ride to this meeting one night, and I figured I'd look bad if I just dropped this guy off and took off. So I went in with him and pretended I gave a darn about the meeting, and I walk in the room, and there's a couple guys over there talking, and they're like, "What about Mortensen? He's been around for a little while." "Yeah, what about that first, second, third? Paul, you're the new secretary. You're not going to say no to an AA request, are you?" I'm like, "Well, what? What just happened, you know?" Okay, and this guy Nate that I had with me wound up being the GSR. I guess these guys wanted to play softball, so they were getting out of there. And so we wound up, trying to run this meeting. I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. I've never been a secretary of anything and shouldn't really be in charge of anything. And eventually, we got enough speaker meetings in town as it is, and people really didn't need to be at another meeting on a Monday because there was about 40 of them, and there was really nobody coming. So we said, well, really, we shouldn't have this a men's-only meeting. I mean, anybody should be welcome. So we opened it up, and a few girls started coming, a few more guys started coming, and it kind of dwindled again. And we thought, this is still not working. What do we do? And I talked to a few people about that, and this guy, Mike H., in passing, I don't even know if he remembers it, but I remember it, said something about, there's enough speaker meetings as it is. Why don't you change it up a little bit? Make it like an Ask It Basket format or something. I thought, cool. I like that idea. So I took that back to the group. We talked about it and thought, what do we got to lose? I mean, there's nobody coming anyway. So we set it up as an Ask It Basket format. And what we do now is we have a basket where people come in, they write in some AA-related questions, throw them in a basket. Speaker will pick something out of it, read the question, answer it based on their experience or occasionally on what they think they know. And we get a lot of different stuff, but it all really comes down to the same thing. It really comes down to the fact that AA works. If you work the program, if you work the steps, and if you keep yourself involved with the traditions, AA works no matter where you go, no matter what you do, no matter which meeting you're in. And so it's been a blast. I think about 6 months ago, Adam and Leah and a few other people that were in the group decided that, we should have something to celebrate this. We've been doing this for a while. It's been an Ask a Basket format for about a year and a half now. And we should have some kind of a shindig to celebrate this. And I was like, no. There's enough roundups in town. It's a really bad idea. And I got completely voted out. And they immediately said, well, we should get Paul to be one of the speakers. I'm like, no. And I got voted out on that, too. I called my sponsor. I'm like, dude, they want me to speak. Everybody's going to think that we invented this meeting so we could have our own roundup so that I can speak. And he says, well, that's probably the case, Paul, but you don't say no to an AA request, so speak. I thought, oh, crap. So here I am. I'm an alcoholic. For me, I guess, as a kid, I didn't know it. But like the big book says that, no one wants to admit that they're bodily and mentally different from their fellows. I couldn't even put a finger on it and describe it to you, but I always felt like I was a little bit not present. Like I hear people say so often, they got the instructions and I didn't. They were there at school a day before me and I wasn't. Or something's missing. And I spent a long time trying to fill a void that I could not describe to you because I didn't know. First time I got loaded, there was a couple times I drank when I was younger. I think when I was five, my parents had parties, and I'd go around and take a sip of this, a sip of that, a sip of that, a sip of that, until they'd put me to bed drunk, and they kind of stopped letting me do that. I know that when I was 10, I have no recollection of having drank too much champagne and kicked my brother in the and my parents said no more champagne for me. I was a little disappointed. But I know when I was 15, my mom's an alcoholic, for the record, and has been for a very long time, and I was absolutely bound and determined not to be a drunk like my mom. I was totally not going to be a drunk. So But something's got to change because I can't live like this. And so when I was on the bus and these guys, Miles and Robin, were in the back of the bus, you know, they're back there. They got their big boom box and they're playing Motley Crue, Shout at the Devil, and headbanging with their leather jackets. And I'm up in the front seat with my little Walkman and my headphones listening to Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Right Round, and thinking I am such a loser. So I thought maybe I should try being a stoner because the stoners are cool. So I asked these stoners if they could get me some stuff. And they're like, what do you mean stuff? You know, like pot or something. And they're like, yeah. So I gave them, you know, I gave them like $5 and they gave me a bag of parsley. And I took it home, snuck it in, smelled it, and thought, I recognize that, and checked the spice cabinet. And sure as hell, I totally got ripped off. They showed up a little bit later at my house to check and see if I was high yet, and I wasn't. But they got me high. And as far as I can remember, and I know this is drug stuff, so I'm not going to go into this for too long, but it was the first time the noise in my head quieted down a little bit. And I can't be a drunk like my mom, and frankly, when you're not 21, it's real hard to get alcohol. So I'll take anything you got, you know. And that was what was available. I did that. Within 6 months, I was in the nut ward. Left the nut ward. They tossed me out of there because I wouldn't open up and tell them why I was getting loaded. Like, I know. I mean, how in the hell am I supposed to tell them? I just know that it makes something okay. So they put me in the boys' ranch, and then I met the real bad boys, and we started going AWOL, running out and hitting the streets and making all kind of trouble. Next thing you know, I'm in and out of juvenile detention over and over and over. Now we're probation violations, and I'm dealing drugs on the street. And you know, I mean, that would have been my preference, would be the drugs. I mean, because even though I'm alcoholic, those were the things that seemed right at the time, you know. And, I mean, my idea of a good time is dropping 3 hits of acid and trying to figure out a Rubik's Cube and a strobe light. Or staring at a lava lamp for hours, talking, listening, meditating. But anyway, I mean, eventually that stuff gets you in trouble, and I don't see myself as an addict. And the reason I don't see myself as an addict is because given a good enough reason to stop, I stopped doing that stuff, you know. Sooner or later, make a long story short, I wound up out of the boys' ranch on the streets, living on the streets, juvenile detention, the streets, juvenile detention, foster home, juvenile detention. And I left Washington State at the age of 18, having been involved in a violent crime, with cops hot on my tail, the dealers hot on my tail, the ex-friends hot on my tail, my parents wondering where the hell I am and if I'm alive. And I shot out to Wisconsin to go live with my mom to get a new start. I don't know if you ever had any new starts that you've tried to do. If you're anything like me, you probably have a pretty good idea how the new starts begin. First thing I did is look for people that look like me, talk like me, act like me, listen to the music I listen to. Spotted him. This guy, I don't even remember what his real name was. I remember we called him Hammer, and he never gave me an excuse as to why we called him Hammer. That's just what they called him. So I hooked up with him, and pretty soon I'm getting thrown out of grandma's house. I'm getting thrown out of my mom's house. I'm getting thrown out of I got thrown. they threw me out of my apartment. Evidently, if you don't pay rent for 10 months, they ask you to leave. And we had trashed the place. And then after that, I was on the streets in Madison. There's a homeless shelter in downtown Madison. They asked me to leave. I don't know what the hell you got to do to get thrown out of a homeless shelter, but evidently not getting a job and showing up loaded all the time does that. So me, Doc, Kid, Bear, pooled all of our state money. I don't even know their real names. Pooled all of our state money that we had gotten and bought this $150 blue beat-up GMC pickup truck that spit gas and oil and stuff all over the place. Pulled up next to a dumpster and threw two easy chairs in the back of this thing facing back. And me and Doc climbed in the back. Bear drove because he was the only one with a license. And, Kid, I think, drove sometimes. He wasn't supposed to, but he did. Whatever. Anyway, those guys hopped in the front, and we drove to North Dakota to join the carnival and get a new start. And I got to, sitting in the back seat of that truck, I got to watch my old life slip away, and it's almost symbolic, you know. As we were watching all the problems and all the troubles and all the difficulties just slip away over the horizon, and there's grass, and it was summertime, and everything was beautiful. Very nice. Almost died. They were driving this truck, trying to pass some lady. And, you know, as we're passing her, I'm like, waving at her, you know, beer, hey, how's it going? And as we just pulled back into our lane, a semi goes boom, right past us. Whoa! You know, this guy was playing chicken with a semi to pass this lady to prove a point. I don't know. Just another one of those things that when I look back on it, it was one of those God conscience moments where I'm like, oh, my God, I could have been dead. So we joined a carnival, and I didn't have any glasses. I just had these prescription sunglasses, so everybody thought I was a BSer, which I was. We ran with the carnival for a while. That's where I met her. I met her behind the tool truck the first day I met her. And it's not podium material. I'm not going to go into that, but we wound up getting married. She talked me into getting a GED, which I did. She talked me into going to college, which I started doing. I went to Northwest Tech here in Moorhead. And, I went from street kid to electronics technician and husband and employee, and I got a job, which led to another job, and I'm starting to make money. But in this time, I also turned 21. You know, I turned 21, I think, the day before we got married. And once you're 21, I don't know if you know this or not, but you can buy alcohol. And you don't have to be a drug runner anymore. But I don't want to be an alcoholic like my mom, but I really like what alcohol does. So I'd buy beer and I'd hang out and I was a druggie and a drunk. And eventually we moved to Fargo. And once we were in Fargo, once again, I hooked up with the people that I hook up with. And, before long, once again, I'm running drugs. I'm doing the illegal stuff that I'm not supposed to be doing. And what happens when you do those things is you get arrested. They find out. They notice. And I got arrested. And I don't know what getting arrested does for you, but it scared the hell out of me. And given a good enough reason, I quit doing that. You know, I did a little bit after that, but really I quit doing that stuff. I turned to the solution for me, which was Mickey's Fine Malt Liquor Brew, which is some darn good stuff. And it's relatively cheap, and it comes in 40s. And you could buy a 40 of it. And after a while, I'd maybe buy two 40s if I had a really good day or a really bad day. And then I'd have two 40s and one of those little 1 ounce airplane bottles of Jose Cuervo. And then I realized those start adding up, so I started getting a little bit bigger bottle of Cuervo. And I started getting 12 packs of the Beast. And then I started getting cases because I realized you could save a dollar instead of buying the two 12 packs and get a little bit bigger bottle of Cuervo. And wasn't very long at all. I'm in the middle of a divorce, and I've got a fifth or a half gallon of Jose in the freezer every day. And I've got a case of beer in the fridge every day, and about every 2 days I'd have to restock. And I was going through probably 12-pack and a half a bottle a day. Perfectly normal, perfectly fine. I'm an American, damn it, and I can drink. I'm 21. I can do what I want. And anybody gave me any flack about it, some of you have seen some old photographs of me. I used to have a real long ponytail, and I used to look like I was about ready to murder puppies. just angry. And I couldn't even put a finger on it then, but the truth of the matter is I was scared out of my mind. And when I'm scared, the only thing I can do is I can back you off, you know? And I get frustrated real easily. I talk fast, think fast, move fast, and I do not have time to wait around for you to get to your damn point, you know? You want to see me twitch, watch me in line at Walmart. It's today, still, you know? I have trouble with being patient, and I'm always in a hurry. And so what came about is, you know, we wound up in this divorce, and I'd already, for some time in this marriage, I'd been drinking on a daily basis. And I would start with her those arguments that we start when we want to get out of the house, you know? And we'd get into an argument and slam some doors, and I'd tell her what I really thought of her, and then I'd leave because I had a right to leave. And I'd go over to Shorty's house, and I'd get loaded, you know? And, you know, as often as possible. I'd say daily. I might be wrong. There might have been a couple of times in there where I tried to prove for a day that I didn't have to drink every day just to show her. And I'd stay so mad about it that it was really miserable for her, and she'd tell me, yeah, you may as well be drinking anyway, you know? You're a jerk. So once her and I split up, I had my own place, and those first 3 months, I was insane. I was crazy. And, I was driving from Fargo to Valley City on the weekends to party with my buddies, and I'd throw a 12-pack into a cooler, and I'd drink and drive all the way, you know, throwing cans up, crush them, throw them out the window, hopefully nobody notices, and, I'd go out there and party and do the stuff that we do. I remember one time, as I was driving back, see, the night before, there was another her. And she had hooked up with my buddy instead of me, and I was terribly upset about that. So I decided at midnight I was going to quit drinking at them. So I stopped drinking at midnight and stayed angrily sober and started, you know, sobering up, basically. And about 5 in the morning, I decided I had enough of that crap, and I was going to drive home. And it's a 60-mile drive. I'd been up all night. I'd been drinking. I'd been getting high. And I said, I'm leaving. And they're like, well, you know, are you sure you're okay to drive? I'm like, dude, I'm a drunk. I know drunk. This is not drunk. I'll be fine, okay? Shut up. And I got in my car, and I started driving. And a little bit past halfway, I start having those long blinks. I don't know if you've had long blinks, you know, where you open two eyes and two tires around a shoulder. I'm like, whoa, pay attention, okay. And then I open my eyes again, and I'm in the left lane of I-94 doing 70 miles an hour on cruise control. I'm like, whoa, pay attention. Turn up the stereo, shake my head, pinch myself a few times. The next time I opened my eyes, it was because my car landed from jumping in between the two sides of the interstate. You know those little access roads the cops use to turn around and chase you? I had hopped one of those in my old 85 Mercury Cougar, landed, and I woke up, and there's grass and water and stuff flying over the hood, and I'm like, you know, took me about a half a second to figure out this is not a dream. I floored it, peeled out, up onto the interstate, got up there, and the first thing I thought was, I wonder if anybody saw that. You know, I'm looking back and forth because that would look bad. I can tell you this, I haven't had any problem with staying asleep since then. So anyway, you know, that's how I roll. That's how I do stuff. And, you know, I like to argue, I like to get into fights, and I like to be right. You know, and I'm not talking fist fights. I'm talking where I go at home and secretly think about all the things I'm going to do to you. I'm not going to really confront you because that would be scary. So I'm going to look really, really ominous and hate you and wear skulls and crossbones and stuff and listen to really angry music. I was, for the record, I was the guy here in town who was with the jacked up 1,000-watt car stereo driving around playing Baby Killer music for the approach from protesters every couple of days on the way to work, driving by them, waving at them, giving the one-figure salute and all that. One of them irritated me one time, so for the next 2 years, I pestered them as often as possible. You know, how the hell do you make amends for that? I mean, so I try and mention that. I mean, because for me to amend means to change too. And, you know, I don't do that kind of stuff today. I don't flip people the bird in the car when I'm driving. I was listening to my first sponsor, the late, great Kane Thompson, who a couple of years ago he went to the great meeting in this guy. Good guy. But in a meeting when I was real new in sobriety, he was talking about how he was driving to the meeting and some guy had cut him off in traffic. And he just about flipped the guy the bird. And then it occurred to him that if he did that he'd feel bad about it later on. He'd feel guilty and he'd have to find a way to track that guy down and go apologize and make amends to him for having done that. And that he really didn't want to have to chase someone down and make amends to him when they were the jerk in the first place, so he just didn't flip the guy off. And I remember thinking, you can do that? You can just not flip somebody off? It was like a spiritual awakening, you know? I'm like, wow, I didn't know. So I try not to do that. Except for Steve and Howard. I occasionally give them the bird, but that's nothing but love. So just, you know, little things like that. I after that first 3 months of insanity, I hooked up with this girl. She was nuts. I met her on the internet. That's where you meet the good ones. And she came over, and we started, I wouldn't call it dating. She kind of moved in and brought her neurosis in with mine. And within 5 months, I don't know how many times I'd gone over thinking about suicide, but at the end of that 5 months, I'd found some things out that really upset me, and she had told me some things that I kind of freaked out about. And I came home one day after work, I got upset, and I threw a tantrum. And by this time, a few days before that, I already made plans to go into the nut ward. I already knew I was on the verge of a complete mental breakdown. And I'd made plans to go into the local nut ward. I'd talked with a whole bunch of places locally, and we'd picked the local psychiatric center here. And so I was going to go into there, but a couple days before I was supposed to actually show up there, I wound up flipping out on her, wound up in a tussle with her, wound up striking her in anger. I've never struck a woman in anger in my life. It was one of those lines I swore I'd never cross, you know. I already know I'm a drunk. Now here I've hauled off and I've hit a woman. And, you know, really I was flat hand. I slapped her on rear end 3 times really hard, but that doesn't matter to me. To me, that's striking a woman in anger. I don't care how you dress that up. And it's wrong, you know, in case you're wondering. And She left, and then she came back and to get her stuff. Well, after she left, I took all the stuff in the house and threw it up against the door because I knew she had a key, and I didn't want her coming in without my permission until it occurred to me that I wanted her to come back. So then I had to move all the crap away from the door and make it so that she could get in. And in the process, I'd torn something of hers. And so when she came back, she saw the thing I tore, and she's like, oh, you're going to wreck my stuff, huh? You want to wreck my stuff? Okay, let's wreck your stuff, you know. How about your precious crystal chessboard? And I'd had this really nice crystal chessboard. It was in the original box with all the pieces in the little styrofoam slots. And it was all, you know, styrofoam, chessboard, styrofoam in a box, in another box. And it was probably my most valued possession at the time, other than me and and my ego. And so I said, yeah, good idea. Let's do that. Let's break the chessboard. And so I went and I got my hammer, and I got the chessboard, and I put it down on the floor. And she's like, no, 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 no. She tries to take the hammer from me. I pushed her up on the bed. I got down on my knees, and I just went crazy on this thing over and over and over and ruined it. I mean, I totally destroyed it. There's pieces of crystal flying all over, cardboard floating, and just trashed it. Cut my finger open in the process. She said, you're crazy, and left. I don't know why she would do that. I was trying to explain to her how much she was making me hurt, and that wasn't the case at all. I was obviously nuts, but she didn't come back that night, and so I wound up walking around the house, and she saw that I was bleeding before she left. She's like, oh my God, you're bleeding all over the place. You know, you're crazy, I gotta leave. And so I'm like, oh, well, you know, whatever. I bandaged it up, and there's blood on the carpet, and it's on the furniture and stuff, and on her jeans jacket, and I'm like, God, where's the guy gotta go to get there, you know? And, at this time, I'm crying in my beer, miserable, wanting to die. And I call up my mom, because, remember, my mom's a drunk. Remember, we mentioned that before. However, at this time, my mom had been sober for quite a while. Because what happened is when I left Washington State with everybody on my tail and went to Wisconsin, my mom saw me and how I looked and the way that I was living and everything, and she went and checked into treatment and sobered the hell up and has been sober ever since. So I wound up calling her, and I talked with her at length that night. And there was something, you know, when I talked with her, I was telling her about how miserable I was and how much I wanted to die and how much I wish I was dead. And she says, well, then why don't you kill yourself? I'm like, what, Ma? What do you mean kill myself? You know, I don't want to die. She's like, well, then why don't you stop saying you do? That's a dirty trick. That's a very dirty trick. So I talked to her. She said, well, why don't you grab another beer and keep talking to me? And I think that's because she knew that that was the only thing that was going to get me through the night. Because for me, alcohol is a solution. It's not the problem, it's the solution. The problem was there long before I took a drink. For me. Maybe you drank your way into alcoholism. If you did, great. That's not my problem. I think for me, though, I've had this imbalance, this spiritual malady that we talk about, this void inside me I could not describe or put a finger on. And alcohol fills that void better than anything else. You know, better than anything else I'd known to that point. And so I talked with my mom. And it wasn't until I was probably 2 years sober, and my first AA roommate had moved out, and I'd had a couple other AA roommates, and people started getting drunk, and we had to move. And I was busy cleaning the carpet in this house when it fired in my memory that the reason I had given myself an excuse to call my mom that night, the last night I drank, was because she used to work in a laundromat, and I needed help figuring out how to get the bloodstains out of the carpet. And it just... 2 years sober, I'm cleaning the carpet, and I start bawling, you know, because I'm like... That's why we had this conversation. That's what happened, you know. And I've had a lot of that, you know, in the last few years here, in my sobriety, where things I had completely forgotten suddenly pop up, and it's like, oh yeah, I did it, you know. I've had amends pop up that I didn't know I had to make. Suddenly remember that time I did this thing, and I'm like, oh crap, great. Now I got to hunt somebody else down. The next day when she came home, she showed up and she said, you know. She explained to me where I was wrong and what I was doing wrong and why I was really messed up and why I needed to change a lot of things. And I'm sitting here nodding and going, yeah, you're right, knowing that this is her fault, and if she hadn't, I wouldn't have, because it's not my fault. And she said, I'm going to a dance later tonight with a guy named Keith. It's an AA dance. You can go if you want. And I'm thinking, AA? And a dance? I mean, it's bad enough it's AA. I've seen you people. You know, AA can't help. All you guys do is sit around and drink your coffee, smoke your cigarettes, talk about your farm, pull up your bib overalls, hold your hands, say your stupid little prayers, and go home. That's not going to help. And I didn't want to go to a dance because I don't want to dance. Not because I can't dance, but because I won't dance. Because if I'm up there dancing, you're going to see me. And if you can see me, you're going to know that I secretly feel awkward and vulnerable. You're going to all stop, turn point, and laugh. The earth is going to open up and swallow me. And I was really uncomfortable with the idea of going to this dance. But I said, yeah, I'll go. And inside I was thinking, not because of any of this stuff, but because you're not going to a dance with another guy without me. I don't think so. So I went to the stupid dance. It wasn't a dance. It was a friggin' roundup. There was like 300 of these people running around in suits and ties and dresses, and they all looked good, and they totally... They weren't me. They weren't, you know, in the leather jacket with the attitude, and they weren't dying. And if you're not dying like I'm dying, then you don't understand me. You don't know anything about me. And I walk into this place, and the first thing that happens, of course, as with any active AA group, is this guy comes shooting across the room with his hand out and says, hi, I'm Kane, are you new? And I was, you know, I'm like, no, I'm thinking to myself, no, I'm not new, I'm not here for the AA meeting, I'm not part of this AA thing, you know, I don't have anything to do with that, I'm checking into treatment on Monday or Tuesday or whatever the hell it is, I'm not going to be able to do that, you know, I'm not here for the meeting, I'm not here for any part of that. I didn't have time to say all that crap, so all I just said was, yes, and, he says, well, let me find you a seat. And he ran me over to this guy, Jeff, and he's like, Chief, this is Paul. It's his first meeting. Can he sit by you? And this guy, Chief, says, no, I'm doing a sobriety countdown. Why don't you have him sit way up there? And they sat me up in, like, the third row. And looking back, I had Scott V over here. Newt was over here scowling at me somewhere. You know, the girl was sitting next to me. There's people looking at me, smiling like, hey, how you doing? I'm thinking, shut up, you know. Quit looking at me. And this guy, Jeff, gets up there, and he goes to do a sobriety countdown. He says his name. And the way this group does their hello is they're like, hi, Jeff! Scared the hell out of me. It's like 300 people screaming at once, blows my hair back. And I'm just like, what the hell was that? And he gets up there. He says, we're going to do a sobriety countdown. We're going to start at, I believe, 30 years that year. And they're going to count backwards. And whoever has the most amount of sobriety in the room gets a free copy of the big book. And I'm thinking, oh, shit. Because I know, and the girl sitting next to me knows, and this guy Kane just found out I was new, and Jeff, this guy up doing a sobriety countdown, knows, and this guy Keith in the back of the room knows. You know, I'm all open, I'm exposed, I'm vulnerable. They know this is a dirty trick, too. And he starts counting down, you know, 30 years, everybody stands up, and they're like, yeah, clap, and, you know, 20 years, and blah, blah, blah. They're down to the 1, 2, and 3 year guys. Everybody there seemed to have 1, 2, and 3 years. And they're getting down to 6 months, 3 months, who has a week of sobriety, and I still haven't stood up. And now he's looking around the room, looking right at me. And I'm like, oh, God. 6 days, looks around the room, looks right at me. Five, you know, comes down to 2 days, looks at me, and I haven't stood up yet. And what he said next saved my life. I don't think anybody said it this way since then at a sobriety countdown at that group. But the way he worded it was, is there anybody here in their first day of sobriety? And I thought, you know, I'm not lying and saying I have a day of sobriety if I stand up. And I don't know why, so I stood up. And I think, frankly, for me, that was the beginning of my step three that day, you know. And I was expecting the AA police to throw me out, you know, because we don't want people here that can't quit drinking. This is AA. We don't drink here. I had no idea what the hell AA was about. So I stood up, and what happened is I got a standing ovation. I had 300 people come out of their chairs, and they all clapped, and they all screamed, and they all sent me up to get the dumb book. And I got the book and sat down and sat in a state of shock for the next 5 hours. But what happened is they got this lady up to the podium to be the speaker that night. This lady, Nancy M. from Minneapolis. And she got to the podium. She didn't talk directly at me, but she told me how I felt. She didn't say anything directly to me, never spoke to me, never, you know, didn't know who I was. But she shared her experience, strength, and hope. She shared about her alcoholism when she was drinking, and she shared about it after, in sobriety. And it was the first time in my life that I really identified with somebody else. It was the first time there was ever really a connection there. This is what's wrong with me. This is what's been going on. I had no idea that there were other people like me. And you know what? It doesn't matter how you dress and what you look like, you know, or where you're from. If you know what alcoholism is, if you've felt it, you know, we know truth when you say it. And I knew truth that night. When she described what was going on, I knew that's what I have. That's me. And I've been coming here ever since. You know, I got that guy came to be my sponsor. And by accident, I went to him and I said, you know, I think I'm going to do this. This sounds like it might work. I'd like to try this. I don't know what to do, though. I don't know who to talk to. I got this book. What do I do? What do I read? What about a sponsor? I mean, between the meeting and him in the smoking area, I think 35 people came up to me and said, hi, how you doing? You got a sponsor. Who are you? You got a sponsor. You need a sponsor. You should get a sponsor. I'm like, God, go away. Leave me alone. And so I went to this guy, Kane, and I said, so what do I need to do to get a sponsor? And he says, I'll sponsor you. I thought, no, not like that. That's not what I meant. But I said, what I said was, what do I do? And I think that's another shot at step three right there. You know, step one, I know I'm powerless over alcohol. It's blatantly obvious before I even get to AA. We don't have to do step one in AA. You do your field research out there, you know. What happens in here is I come in here and I hear you. I hear truth. I hear when you describe what happens. When I take a drink of alcohol, I have a bizarre thing that happens. I actually get thirsty for more alcohol, you know. And after a drink, I want another drink. And after two drinks, I'm probably going to have four. After four, it's highly likely I'm going to drink 8 drinks tonight. After 8 drinks, it's pretty probable that 16 is going to be the finishing number tonight. And usually somewhere between 16 and 32, I'm throwing up clam chowder through my nose one more time, telling myself, I have got to stop this. I'm going to die. And I wake up the next morning, you know, full of remorse, with a firm resolution not to do that again tonight. And I get up, and I go to work, and I'm pale, and I'm shaky, you know, and I'm sweating alcohol. They actually confronted me on that at work. They said, you know, there's people saying that you smell like alcohol and you're drinking at work. I was like, oh, no, that's I was drunk the night before and every night. So I could probably pass a breathalyzer if they didn't sample my sweat, because I wasn't bathing a lot then either. So it's blatantly obvious that I cannot safely take a drink. It's also become very obvious that I can't not take a drink, because every time I try to stop drinking, quit drinking, don't drink, something starts whispering in the back of my head saying, you know, you had a really crummy day today, Paul. Things haven't gone well today. You know, what you could do is maybe just have a couple. And I drive home telling myself, no, I'm not drinking, I'm not drinking. And then it hits me that maybe instead of drinking all that stuff I normally drink, maybe I could just get a six-pack of that really nice, dark, thick Nectar of the Gods Sam Adams beer and have just one or two of those, and that'll take the edge off, and that'll calm me down. You know, because when I'm not drinking, I start getting irritable and tense and restless and frustrated, and people get dumber and slower, and they won't pay attention, You know, you want to see me freak out again, Walmart, all these people that aren't evidently aware that I'm in a hurry. And they won't move. They won't get out of the way. They won't hurry up and pay for their stuff or let me through the line. And I have to stand there and wait, and I really don't want to. And the more sober I get, the worse it gets. And the more irritating they get. And the closer I get to just randomly slapping people in Walmart, which probably won't go well either. So, step two. Interesting thing about step two is I'm still not entirely certain that this is going to work. I'm coming up a little bit, here, about another month, I think. I'm going to come up on 7 years. I don't think I really did step two until I'd already done all the other steps and been around here for a while, and suddenly I started to believe maybe this is going to work, you know? Step three, I asked for help. In a nutshell, I asked for help. I said, what do you want me to do? I want to do this. What do you want me to do? And ever since then, I mean, I've been coming here and doing the stuff we do here. I went and I did an inventory. I did a written inventory. And there's debate on which one's the right one to do. The one that keeps you sober, I would guess, is probably the one you should do. Do one, whatever you do. And so I did this written inventory, and Kane and I went off, and we went driving around, and I read this thing off to him, you know. And in the process of reading this off to him, there was this, see, there were certain things on there I didn't want anybody to know about. There's, you know, about 11 lines on this one page that were really, really, we're not going to discuss this kind of things ever, you know. And I've hopefully left this crap in my past, and now you want me to write it down. And as I was doing my fourth step, I was thinking, I can't put that one on there, and I can't put that one on there, and I can't. And it was almost like this voice popped in my head and said, what do you think you've been running from, Paul? So I wrote the stuff down. I mean, we agreed to go to any lengths, right? So I wrote the stuff down, and, you know, we went out driving, and I think that was the second page in the inventory. I read that stuff off to him, and he didn't laugh at me. He didn't make me get out of his car. He didn't say a damn thing. You know, he just kept driving. And after the inventory, when we were done and doing this fifth step, he said, is there anything else? And I said, I don't think so. Why? What do you know? You know? He said, well, some of the people that have done these inventories with me have things on there like a resentment against God. But, you know, I'd already been sober a couple of months by then. I wasn't mad at God anymore. I was so damn grateful to be alive that I wasn't mad at God anymore. I wasn't mad at my parents anymore. Well, my stepmom had things that I really was upset with her about still, but that was on there. But there was, you know, there was a lot of stuff on there. I wasn't upset anymore. In fact, one of the biggest fears I had was that you guys had asked me to leave, because what you guys have given me is a life beyond anything I'd ever intended to get, you know. I can wake up in the morning and I don't have to wonder what I did last night. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in my life today that are, it's beautiful, you know. So six and seven, step six is where I hung. I didn't want to let go of certain character defects. I was having a really good time with some of these character defects. Kane, when he presented me for my one-year medallion, said that he could count on one hand the number of times that I did not take a suggestion that he gave me. That was Amanda, Heather, Bobby Joe, Renee. And at the time, there was this girl that I was having a fling with that she looked like a porn star, actually, Ron Jeremy. And It was a bad deal. It was a bad deal. So I finally talked to him about this stuff, and, you know, one more time I had done that thing, and I just, it wasn't funny anymore. It wasn't interesting anymore. And I called him up. I said, I'm sick of this. What do I do? And he told me, you know, go to page such and such and read these two paragraphs. And I did, and I did the little prayer that they've got there. And I hit my knees, and I did the seven-step prayer and asked God to remove everything that stands in the way of my usefulness to him and others. Didn't say anything about making me feel good about me. Just make me useful. I'm sick of being useless. Where can I help? What can I do? And there was no part in between step seven and step eight where God came thundering out of the heavens full of lightning bolt and thunder on his flaming chariot and wiped away every defect of character. In fact, that still has not happened. Hang out with me outside of here, you know, in here, whatever. But what I did do is after that, I made a list of all the people that I had caused harm with and all the places and institutions and all this stuff. And I went about trying to make amends with these people and correct this stuff and straighten out where I was wrong. Because we're not about getting you to stop being mad at me anymore. We're about me cleaning up my side of the street so I'm not carrying around the guilt, shame, and remorse that gets guys like me drunk, you know. It's for me to go out there and clean it up and make it right and not have to be looking over my shoulder all the time. So we did that stuff, and I continue on, too, with the other steps. I mean, 10 is really, to me, 4 through 9 every day. I continue to look for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear when these crop up, which is one of the promises, because that stuff does. You know, I ask God, well, not always at once, but I ask God to remove that stuff, you know. And I try and make amends when I need to make amends, you know. And a lot of times, the stuff I think and things I feel, I don't always say the things I want to say. I've got that that pause before one of those defects jumps out and I do something or say something I'm going to regret later. So what it's afforded me is the same thing with alcohol, because by the time I get to step 10, the obsession to drink's gone. I haven't thought about a drink in a long time. I mean, I've given it thought, you know, what if I did this? And it seems like such a ludicrous idea that it's easy for me to just go, what a dumb idea, that I can't even afford that, you know. And that makes sense. It's no longer that undeniable, absolute need on the deepest of levels to go have a couple of drinks and then trigger the craving, get good and drunk, make a fool of me, blah, 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 on and on. So, you know, I continue to pray. I continue to meditate. And when I meditate, I don't sit down and try and completely turn off my brain. To meditate on something is to think about it, ponder it, to contemplate, you know. And so I'll sit, you know, I had this little spiritual awakening a month or two ago where it suddenly occurred to me that that prayer in the 11th step in the 12 and 12 is actually says this is something to meditate on. It doesn't say this is a prayer you run around and say. It says this is something to meditate on. So that prayer of St. Francis is listed as a meditation. So what I do is I go through and I'll take a line out of that and I try and think about that. Make me a channel of your peace. Oh, what's a channel? A channel is a way from to get from one place to another. So that it's not give me peace, but allow me to give other people your peace. You know, allow me to share this with other people. And little by little, as I go through that, it kind of changes the way that I look at things, you know. And when you change the way that I look at things, when you change the way that I see the world and I react to the people around me, you little by little change who I am at a fundamental level. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I now have something I can turn around and try to carry on to somebody else. And I've learned in here, I learned early on, you can't keep it unless you give it away, you know. If you don't give it away, it'll go away. You know, you can't sit here and just not share this thing, because this is not a selfish program. There's nowhere in a book that says it's a selfish program. It says getting rid of self, getting out of self-centered, self-serving, self-seeking garbage is absolutely necessary, or I'm not going to be able to stay sober, you know. So I got to get out of self. I got to quit being selfish. I got to turn around and give this away. I got to answer the phone when people call. I try and give people rides when I can give people rides. You know, I try to take time when I'm too damn busy to sit down and talk with another drunk anyway. You know, I try and do that stuff and try not to make it about me, because none of this is based on any of my good ideas. My good ideas get me in trouble with the law. They get me in divorce court. They get me in custody battles. They get me in handcuffs. They get me in all kinds of bad places. However, they've never gotten me sober. They've never gotten me happy. They've never gotten me happy with all the stuff I have. Today I got a lot of stuff in my life, but as Dustin one time pointed out, stuff comes and goes. Stuff comes and goes. I've been broke in sobriety. I've had money in sobriety. I've gotten divorced in sobriety. I've gotten married in sobriety. You know, I've enjoyed being with my kids. I've worried about being with my kids. I mean, I've got all kinds of stuff. The one thing that I've never stopped doing is I never stopped coming to AA meetings. I've never stopped working the steps. I never stopped praying. I never stopped doing the core fundamental things that I've been taught from the beginning that you got to do in here. I mean, this is what it says in there is here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. The program is not a club where we get to hang out and just be happily sober together. You know, it's not. It's a program of action that is laid out in very simple little numbered steps in order on here's how you get what we've got. You know, so I'm not in the program and I'm not in recovery. I work a program, and as a result, I have experienced recovery. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Doesn't mean I'm cured of alcoholism. I can go out and take a drink today. I trigger the craving. The obsession of the mind will come back like that, and I'm gone. And because of my ego, I'll probably never be back, you know? And I don't want to be that guy either. So what I've got today is a daily reprieve. I get one day, today, right here and now, where if I do the stuff that I've been taught to do in here that you guys showed me, you didn't just tell me about it. You didn't share your knowledge. You shared your experience. There's a huge difference, in my opinion, between what you know and what you've actually done, you know. And as you can tell me everything there is to know about swimming, but if you don't paddle, you're going to drown. So what you guys have done is you've given me a solution to that which ails me. You've given me a solution to the problem I couldn't even describe to you. I came in here and you guys described it for me. And I think for me, you know, it's important that when somebody new comes in that we make it a point to explain that stuff to them too, you know. Because I didn't know that when I'm angry it's because, you know, somebody hurt me or I'm frightened of something or I'm getting frustrated. I didn't know that's what really is underneath when I'm ticked off. So why am I angry? What's going on? You see somebody angry, try and help them out. Try and say, you know, what's going on? What's going on in your world? And when I do that, I'm not thinking about me. And when I'm not thinking about me, my problems aren't such a big deal. You know, I was sober for, I don't know, 3-4 years, maybe 5 years. And I was bun. I don't even remember what it was. You know, that's how important this was. But I was losing my mind. And I called up my buddy Steve W. He'd moved down to St. Cloud. You know, Steve's my best friend, has been for a long time. And if you don't have friends like that in AA, get some, you know, because it's very important. I call up Steve and I ranted, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 minutes. I'm like, blah, 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 this problem here and blah, 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 and this person's wrong. They're doing it wrong over there. And if they just pay attention, blah, blah, blah. And I finally wind down. I'm like, And Steve's like, so, Paul, you're struggling? Yeah, man, I am. Don't struggle. I just get up yours, man, right on the nose. That's a problem, you know? When I'm struggling, I haven't surrendered. When I'm struggling, I'm kicking and screaming and swinging, you know? And it's up to me to let go, you know? Because you can't let God if you can't let go. And sometimes it takes people close to me to remind me to let the hell go. Calm down. You're going to be okay, you know? There is a God out there. I don't know who it is. I'm not going to put a name to him. And I hope that nobody makes me, you know? Because my God, I don't have to do that. And my God doesn't have to be angry. I don't have to follow any given set of rules. I don't have to follow any given set of laws. What I have to do is I have to follow the instructions in here. Real damn simple, you know? And I have to try and give this back to somebody else, you know? Or this could all go away real quick. So I don't know. The time is running short here. I was thinking is, you know, when I was sobering up, I was getting into the steps. I was getting into the recovery thing. And I'm having a blast. I mean, you get a buzz doing this. You get really charged, especially around between, you know, 9 months, 10, 11 months. I mean, these people get just crazy high on AA. And I was at work, standing outside, smoking, having a good time. And this guy, his name's Paul, actually. Looks like Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. Comes shuffling along the parking lot. And he's one of my old stoner buddies, actually. And as he's walking by, you know, I'm like, he says, how you doing? I'm like, man, I am great. I mean, my life is coming together. Things are going so well. I feel just so good. And the sun is out and the birds are, you know, it's just beautiful. And he looks at me with this, oh, God, kind of look. And I'm like, how are you doing? He's like, well, I'm feeling rotten, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm doing great, man. Everything's great. And he's like, fine. So you're one of those glass half full people. I'm a glass half empty kind of guy. And he shakes his head and goes in the building. And I'm like, man, I'm just happy to have a glass. I got to thinking, shit, that's profound. That's good stuff. when I can keep that mindset, doesn't matter whether it's going well or not. I get to be here. I'm damn lucky to be here because guys like me don't live to get to do the stuff I get to do. I don't get to be a part of life. I don't get to be a dad. I don't get to be a husband. Usually we're not employees for very darn long, you know. So I've gotten a lot out of this deal. I mean, I've had a lot of stuff happen in sobriety. I had this long list of really clever things I was going to share with you today, and I think I left it at home unwritten, but who cares, you know? I mean, I've got to be a part of life. I've got to make some pretty cool things have come about in my life. I was probably 2.5 years sober, and through my whole sobriety, my brother would call me every month or two, drunk. He'd call me up just hammered, tell me about how my wife was doing this, and she was saying that, and blah, 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 and I almost hit her, and I was so right, and blah, 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 and I'm listening to this going, dude, wow, you know? And I'm like, well, have you tried going to AA? He's like, oh, I don't have time for AA. He'd call me up again later on in the month and say, man, I found this new pill on the internet supposed to cure alcoholism. What do you know about it? Not a damn thing, Josh. I go to AA meetings. I have no idea, you know? He's like, whoa. And I was, I think, 2.5 years sober. Coming up on 3 years, I think. And my brother calls me up and says, man, I got 90 days. I'm going to AA. I'm going to meetings. I just... You know, I'm sure for my mom it was real cool when I sobered up and got to tell her what it was like to be sober and I got to start having fun with it. Because I know for me when Josh got that, you know, that was real cool to have been there and just been one of the links in the chain that got to help him get there. You know, his first year I sent him a 1-year sobriety medallion and he thought that was pretty cool, you know. And he was coming up on his 2nd year sobriety birthday and he calls me up. He's like, hey, you're going to send me a 2-year medallion? I'm like, no. Why not? I said, you don't need a medallion. He's like, but I'm collecting them. I'm like, dude, one is not a collection. It's a medallion. Calm down. So what I did is I got him one of those fancy certificates. You can buy the empty certificate paper at Walmart or whatever. And I printed up the certificate in honor and recognition of Joshua, blah, you know, as a result of not drinking for 2 years, he hasn't had to crash his car, explain his drinking, hide his booze, throw up bile, blah, blah, blah. Just a big list, a paragraph of all the things that, you know, ain't this great? And I said, but since normal people don't do that anyway, you have been awarded the shiny red star. And I got a little shiny red star, put it right in the corner. And then I said, in addition to that, since we do this one day at a time, I'm also including the 24-hour medallion that I've carried in my pocket. And I threw in, because I got one of the fancy brass ones, a little 24-hour medallion, because that's all we get is today, right? You know, just today. One day at a time, we get to do this. And I stuck that in there, and I sent that to him. And framed the thing, you know, so he could hang it on the wall and let everybody know what a jerk his brother is. Sent it to him, and he just said thanks to me. But I was talking with my mom a few days later, and apparently he was talking with my mom, and he said, man, it's his medallion. It's, like, worn out and everything. This is so cool. And I got a little charge out of that. You know, there's a lot of neat things that have happened in sobriety. But it's not about just being sober. It's about being sane. It's about being okay. It's about being all right in the world. I'm not all right all the time. And anybody that tells you any different is selling something. We don't get to be wonderful all the time. We don't get to just relax and take it easy 24/7. I'm sorry. I'm not that guy. I'm nuts. And Paul's a lot of work. But if I do the work, I don't ever have to take a drink again. And if you're new tonight, you don't have to drink anymore. There's people here that are willing to help, a whole room full of people. So don't leave without asking for help. Thanks for letting me talk.